From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, MSU's former president charged with lying to police as they investigated sexual abuse complaints against Larry Nassar.
It's like accusing her of a cover-up, that she was not completely truthful with them. Not that she necessarily lied, but that she wasn't truthful with regard to what had been going on at Michigan State.
What will and won't be okay once pot is fully legal December 6th.
Businesses that are trying to have people buy products and give away marijuana for free would be a clear violation, and that shouldn't be happening.
Amanda Saab was the first hijab-wearing contestant on MasterChef. Her newest food adventure, her Livonia Bakery.
We're getting ready for Thanksgiving, one of the biggest food holidays of the year.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Former MSU President Luana Simon is expected to be arraigned next Monday in district court in Eaton County. She's been charged with lying to police during their investigation into accusations about Larry Nassar and what MSU knew and when. Simon faces two felony and two misdemeanor charges, and if convicted, she faces up to 4 years in prison. Peter Henning is a former federal prosecutor who's now a professor at Wayne State University Law School. Peter, these charges stem from Simon's interview with MSU police. In 2014, they were investigating a Title IX complaint by Nassar survivor Amanda Thomashow. Exactly what is she accused of doing?
Well, the headlines have all said that Dr. Simon's accused of lying, but under the statute that she's been charged with, it covers not only making a false statement to the police, but also misleading the police about what's called any material fact in the criminal investigation. So I think what the prosecution, what the special attorney general is going to focus on is that her statements were incomplete, and therefore they were designed to try to mislead about Dr. Nassar's potential involvement in the sexual abuse. And so essentially it's like accusing her of a cover-up, that she was not completely truthful with them. Not that she necessarily lied, but that she wasn't truthful with regard to what had been going on at Michigan State.
And actually looking at the warrant here, the quote that is highlighted in the counts are that she said to police, "I was aware that in 2014 there was a sports medicine doc who was subject to a review." And the complaint says she knew at the time it was Larry Nassar who was the subject. Help us understand, we have two felony and two misdemeanor charges for what seem to be the same thing. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. Under the statute that she's charged under, if the police investigation involves a serious felony, and in this case it would be criminal sexual conduct, then if you lie or mislead police in that kind of an investigation, that's a felony charge. What's interesting is it's the exact same charge for a misdemeanor, and that is, in this case, they were also investigating Nassar for misconduct in office. It will be up to the jury to decide which one, if the case gets that far, it'll be up to the jury to decide, did she obstruct the criminal sexual conduct investigation or just the misconduct in office investigation? That will decide whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. So the special attorney general is being very careful here to make sure to charge everything possible.
Now, you said if the case gets to a jury, what would be the roadblocks?
Well, if she were to agree to some kind of plea bargain, I would expect that before these charges were filed yesterday, that they had tried to work something out. But sometimes a defendant won't accept a plea offer until the evidence is put in front of them and they see the ramifications. Or if she's decided to fight this, then the case goes forward and it will go to trial probably in the next few months, although we don't know for sure how much evidence the state has, and that could delay how this case is processed through the system.
And what are the challenges the prosecution faces in a lying to police case? How would you typically approach a charge like this?
Well, what the prosecutors need to show is two things. One, that her statement was not complete, and also what she knew, that she was aware of additional facts that she didn't share. And this is where it gets fuzzy. And I think the real challenge for the prosecution is going to be that language is very slippery. So when Dr. Simon said, "I was aware," exactly what did she know at that point in time? Now, she's the president of a large state university, and does she have her finger on the pulse of everything? The answer to that question is probably not. She may be able to offer a defense that, "I didn't know. I didn't want to make some kind of false statement to the police officer, so I gave them as much as I knew at that point in time." That could be an effective defense. And another important issue is going to be, what did the police officers ask? Because we have the answers, but we don't have the questions that she was asked. Maybe her answer was as truthful as she could make it. That's going to have to come out eventually.
Peter Henning, Wayne State University Law School, a former federal prosecutor. It's always great to get your perspective, Peter. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Next Monday, the Board of State Canvassers will meet to certify results of the midterm election. And once that certification happens, recreational marijuana will be legal in Michigan on December 6th. Well, let's talk about what happens then. Josh Hovey is with us. He's with the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. Josh, first things first, let's set expectations straight. On December 6th, will people be able to walk into a pot shop and buy recreational marijuana?
No, you'll still need a medical marijuana card to purchase marijuana from any of the provisioning centers until the adult use marijuana licenses are granted by the state. And the state has pretty much a year to develop the rules and regulations for the marijuana businesses and get them up and running. So we're likely to see the first sales happening around 2020. Until then, you'll have to be a medical marijuana card holder to purchase anything legally.
Give us a sense then, from December 5th to December 6th, how will things change? What will be legal and what won't?
Personal possession will become legal. Essentially, you could think about the phases of legalization under Proposal 1 in two phases. The first phase is decriminalization, where personal possession will become legal. You can have it on your person, 2.5 ounces. You can grow plants, 12 plants per household in your home, but there will be no sales until businesses are licensed and operational, and the state has a year to develop those rules and regulations for the businesses and get them licensed.
So looking at other states, Colorado, and really wherever we've seen pot legalized, there's this lag time between decriminalization and stores being open. So we've seen it where a store will sell a $60 chocolate cookie and give you some free weed, thus circumventing these awkward rules. Will we see this, do you think?
If you do see it, you should report it, because that would be illegal. That's very specifically detailed in the proposal that that type of behavior is not intended in this initiative and is a clear violation of what's intended, which is legalized, regulated sales. Businesses that are trying to have people buy products and give away marijuana for free would be a clear violation, and that shouldn't be happening. Nor should people be out celebrating smoking marijuana in the streets, because public consumption would be still illegal under this initiative, as would driving under the influence, going to work under the influence, all of those things that remain illegal today in terms of public consumption or just irresponsible behavior would still be banned regardless of Proposal 1's impact.
So what could be some potential roadblocks to a smooth rollout in Michigan?
The roadblocks are really the regulatory side and making sure that there is a smooth transition. I know that Governor-elect Whitmer has been supportive of legalization and wants to make sure that the process is fair for all the businesses that want to apply. And our organization has already met with the State Licensing and Regulatory Affairs Department, which will be responsible for developing the rules and regulations for these new businesses. And, you know, they think they have a pretty good model in place already for medical marijuana. Our initiative was modeled after the medical marijuana licensing law. You know, they think they can transition fairly smoothly. And because our initiative doesn't have the licensing board that has really delayed the implementation of medical marijuana, the state thinks that they can be a little bit more streamlined in their process and remove a layer of government that, you know, they believe they're very good at their jobs already, and we agree. And so we think this will be a much smoother transition than we've seen with medical marijuana.
You know, Josh, we're hearing from some municipalities who have the right to opt out and say they are going to exercise that right to opt out. In that case, if you live in one of these cities or towns that are going to opt out of having legalized marijuana, will it be illegal to possess it? What's the do's and don'ts there?
No, if you live in a community that decides to opt out from the initiative, then you'll still be able to possess and grow limited amounts of marijuana in the privacy of your own home. The only thing you won't be able to do is have a store located in your town. And, you know, that's every community's right, but we're encouraging communities to think about how their voters responded to Proposal 1 and make sure that they're adhering to the wishes of their voters and not banning these initiatives or these businesses entirely. And, you know, we're not getting overly concerned because some communities are taking a proactive approach and saying, well, we're going to wait and see what rules the state develops first before we decide to allow any businesses. And they can always go back and change their initiative. So we're not getting overly excited by the communities that have decided to take a proactive approach. Hopefully they'll come back and take a look at the rules and regulations and then have another public discussion about whether they want to opt in after that.
So bottom line, presuming that the certification happens next Monday, come December 6th, recreational marijuana is legal in Michigan, but it won't officially become legal to sell until probably 2020.
Correct. And really what we're going to see is just a law enforcement redirecting their efforts away from low-level possession issues and focus on the things that really are impactful to the quality of life in our community, things like the opiate epidemic and violent crime and property theft. That's where we want law enforcement spending their time, and that's the main reason why we wanted to bring marijuana legalization to Michigan. And so we're happy to see that take place.
Just one question. For people who have not perhaps indulged in buying marijuana up until now, and now knowing it's going to be legal and they want to try it, where would they get weed?
Until the stores are operational and licensed, you'll have to know a friend of a friend, because gifting marijuana is legal. If you know somebody who's growing in their own home, they could offer you some, but they're not allowed to sell. And so it's kind of a decriminalization phase up until the businesses are operational in 2020.
Josh Hovey with the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. Josh, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we head to the Butterbear shop in Livonia.
The key we use around here is butter. Butter, 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 always butter.
Spice cakes, baklava cheesecakes, and much more for Thanksgiving. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. It's Thanksgiving week, so in addition to the parade, the family, friends, the festive food, and Black Friday, it's time to think about sending out holiday greetings or FaceTiming that someone who's just too far away to visit. Connecting with family and friends through cards, letters, video chat, it's commonplace today. But let's go back to the late 1930s, early 1940s, and that's when one Michigan family took a very modern approach to staying connected with each other, not with letters, not with cards, but with voice recordings on 78 RPM records. Here now to explain is State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. So, Mark, who was this family and how in the world did they wind up sending voice recordings to each other in, like, 1939?
The Stebbins family was spread out around Michigan and Ohio. They were just a very forward-thinking group of people. They didn't have one, but we estimate nine of these recording units in 1939. And they chose to use these instead of writing the traditional cards or greeting. They would just record their holiday greeting or just a update on the weather, almost like a audio postcard. In fact, I think that's how they were marketed as.
So before we take a listen to a clip of a greeting, what's the machine they're using to record these greetings on?
They are using the Wilcox-Gay Recordio. They were released in 1939. This company made other audio components back to 1910. They came out with the Recordio in 1939, really beating most other big companies like Philco and others to the market. There were home record cutters, as they're generically called, available before this, but they're mostly the kind you have to assemble on your own. You know, you have to put the kit together or do some strange things that weren't really easy to get a quality recording. And, you know, vinyl's been around for a while, but this puts the technology in the hand of anybody, and they're cutting the record on a cardboard substrate, so you don't have to mess with lacquer or anything like that. It's really simple, easy, and this company from Charlotte, Michigan, beat everybody to the punch.
All right, so let's hear the product. We're going to take a listen now to the very first Thanksgiving greeting that the Stebbins family sent, and this was in 1939.
There's no snow this Thanksgiving day, so I can beat Dave Bishop in a game of golf. I'm also glad the family is still here, so I can get a good meal and enjoy their pleasant company. And I'm sure happy that Charles is a good engineer to control the operations of this new radio recorder.
I am thankful because I get 2 days off from school, and that we are not at war, that we are not governed by a man like Hitler or Stalin. I'm also thankful because Raleigh did not sit next to me during dinner.
Living in the Stebbins family is why I'm thankful. At this Thanksgiving Day gathering, 1939, 8 of us are present. The bonds of Stebbins' interest are such that gatherings like this are not at all unusual. Perhaps Dad has another reason.
I'm thankful that I don't have to sit down and eat another such dinner as I have just eaten, at least for a few hours. But it really was a wonderful meal. Turkey, nuts, potatoes, gravy, meringues, and ice cream, and so forth. Reminds me of a dinner I had a short time ago at Eaton Rapids at the woolen mills.
Do they serve meals there?
Why, sure. Didn't you ever eat there at the cafeteria? They serve very famous food. They make a specialty of boll weevils, fried. Fried just crisp enough, but not too crisp. They know how. The waitress brought me in a couple and asked which one I wanted, and I said, I preferred the lesser of two weevils. Thank you.
You know, it is something to listen to voices and realize those, you know, that they sat around probably around the table or around the living room and recorded that in 1939. A lot more emotional impact than an email or a text message.
Absolutely.
So how many of these machines you said the Stebbins family had, they all kind of shared in them?
Yeah, they said 9, and they were anywhere from vacation homes up in Harbor Springs, over in the Alpena area, Marshall, East Lansing, Lansing, and then one of a family member in Ashtabula, Ohio. So they were all over the place. Everybody got on board. You know, imagine the first smartphone coming out, and usually you have one or two early adopters in a family.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of sits around the Thanksgiving table marveling at it. Well, they went all in. Everybody got them.
So you sit down, you and the family do your greetings. Dad tells his terrible dad joke, and you have this greeting, and then it's in the form of what we used to call what I knew is 78 RPM records.
So they're recorded at 78 RPMs, but they look like a 45. It's sort of confusing.
But it's a little record, and off it goes, and you could pop it on any record player.
Yeah, it came with a self mailer, so you would mail it, and then you could just put it on any record player. In fact, you know, we have a modern one here in the archives, and you can put it on and play it now.
That's something. So this greeting was the first one they did in 1939. How popular did this technology get? I'm thinking, you know, as the 1940s move on, you've got World War II going on. You've got people all over scattered hither and yon. Did this become widespread?
Yeah, the estimates are that first year they sold 25,000 units. People like Johnny Cash and Les Paul bought them to have their own little home recording. You know, imagine what today we have now is like a video recorder. They could record tracks. They could do that in their home without going to a studio. So it had wide notoriety. And then it's 1939, a couple years later, we're fully engaged in World War II, and you see soldiers recording on the recordios and sending home these to their family members so they can hear their voice instead of just reading a letter, which is obviously much more poignant than a written letter.
Very, very much so. And I'm looking at an advertisement for the Wilcox Gay Recordio 1940 home recording. I see there is the big low boy, so that would be the one you'd keep at your house for $129.95, which is pretty big coin for
that time in our history. But there was also the portable recordio. So I could see why perhaps if you're, in the European theater, but, back at headquarters, you're, if you're behind the lines, you might be able to knock out a greeting to mom and dad.
Yeah, and we should describe how this looks. So imagine people are probably familiar with the cabinet-sized radios or record players. This is a cabinet-sized record player, and it has two arms, though. It has a cutting arm for when you record and a playing arm. So imagine a record player with arms on either side with an attached, very vintage-looking microphone, like you would see maybe in a radio station. And then a lot of the higher-end units would also have the radio embedded into it. And what was really cool is that if you were tired of listening to your own voice, you could just click a button and record what was ever on the radio. So I like to think, this is the advent of the mixtape.
There you go. And now we know that the collection, the Stebbins collection, has been donated to the Archives of Michigan. How many recordings are there? And what sticks out to you about what's in these holiday greetings?
Well, one of the first things that is noticeable on that first recording, you hear sort of the enamoration with the technology, maybe a little discomfort with the fact that people are having their voice recorded. That would be a pretty new experience. I mean, people have been listening to radio, but to be able to record your own voice and play it back immediately would be quite strange. But over time, you hear the discussion get a little more casual. They really start using the technology just to send a quick greeting as opposed to this formalized recording where they feel like they have to have all their P's and Q's in a row.
Well, it is a lovely way to travel back in time and sit in the living room with the Stebbins family as they share their Thanksgiving greetings on the Wilcox Gay Recordio, home recording 1940s style. Hey, thank you so much, Mark Harvey, our state archivist with the Michigan History Center, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Metro Detroiter Amanda Saab trained to be a social worker, but food and baking kept calling her back. Amanda was a contestant on Master Chef Season 6, and she founded Dinner with Your Muslim Neighbor to combat Islamophobia. Her latest food adventure is her Livonia Bakery Butter Bear Shop. Yesterday, I went to watch Amanda and her team in action amidst the Thanksgiving rush.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm Cindy.
Amanda, so nice to meet you.
So wonderful to meet you.
Thank
I just
you.
Have to say, Butter Bear smells better than any place I've been, and I can't remember when.
Oh, thank you.
Mm, yay. It's wonderful. And you're busy, and everybody's jamming things out here, making all kinds of beautiful things.
Thank you. Yeah, we're getting ready for Thanksgiving, one of the biggest food holidays of the year.
So I'm here with Amanda Saab at her bakery, Butter Bear Shop in Livonia. And I have to just start with that wonderful, wonderful name, Butter Bear Shop. Tell
Thank
me the story
you.
Behind the name.
Yeah, so my nickname growing up was Manda Panda Bear. And I call my daughter Hannah Bear. And ironically enough, my father-in-law's name is Dib, which means bear in Arabic. And I just thought that was the funniest thing when I met my husband. I'm like, your dad's name is Bear? Like, is that actually a thing? So we're like obsessed with bears. And then butter. So Butterbeer just kind of came together. I mean, I'm a big Harry Potter fan too, so I don't know if Butterbeer had influence in subconscious mind we were thinking. And I started from home, but I wanted it to sound like so official. So like shop just made me feel like I was striving for the storefront shop. I was working towards that brick and mortar. So it made it real for me. So
yeah.
Butterbeer Shop was born.
Show us around a little bit. I'd love to see what you're making, especially what the big orders are for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so we have all sorts of pies. We have a traditional like apple lattice, and then for apple crumble pie, we added cardamom to the crumble just because I love that like spiced floral. They pair so nice with the Granny Smith apples. We have lots of cheesecakes to make too tonight, so we baklava cheesecakes. People are loving it, and I'm so excited to be able to share something I created myself like with so many different people.
All right, who's this here working?
This is Patty.
Hi, Patty.
Hello.
Well, what are you making?
So right now I'm working on our spice cake, which we have on our Thanksgiving menu. And so once they come out, they get some icing and a nice caramel drizzle. So
what's the key to a beautiful, beautiful spice cake?
The key we use around here is butter. Butter, 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 always butter.
This This is Mona. This is actually my little sister.
Oh, little sister. She's got you in here working.
Of course, yes.
What are you making?
I'm making the graham cracker crust for our cheesecakes.
Now, tell me about that. Oh, I heard baklava cheesecake, and I went, what? We've had baklava. Tell me how you created that.
I was, like, playing with phyllo, and then I, like, just kept coming back to cheesecake because it was the first thing I learned how to bake when I was in fourth grade. So I just kept coming back, and I'm like, what if I, like, lay the phyllo below, like, as a crust? And I was like, what if I put it on top? And it, like, actually sits perfectly above the cheesecake because it's so rich and dense. So it actually holds up the 12 layers of phyllo dough and all the walnuts and pistachios in the filling.
Now, I know, and you mentioned that you took kind of a diversion to social work. Went to school for that. So what brought you back to baking and running this bakery?
Yeah, so as I started my career as a social worker, I was working in the hospital, so in the neonatal intensive care unit. And that was, like, super heavy work. So my way to kind of process and, like, deal with it in my self-care was through baking. So I would take pictures of my stuff and post it online, and then people were like, oh, you should totally do a blog. And I was like, I don't have time for that. And I was like, you know what? I should. Like, then it's something to pass on, and it's, like, a legacy. And instead of, like, having, like, those little note cards that are, like, oil-stained, it's, like, on the internet, and it's, like, safe forever, hopefully. So I started with that, and then a year after that, I decided to audition for MasterChef. My husband was like, you'd be so good at that. You should totally do it. Like, why not try? And I was like, yeah, why not? Like, I have a super stressful job. I need some fun and excitement. So I auditioned and made the show. And
Season six. And I know that you were the first woman to appear on MasterChef wearing a hijab. And I'm wondering, what did you leave the show feeling most proud of?
I think I was feeling most proud that I stayed my authentic self and I didn't allow, like, the cameras or, like, the production and, like, the need for, like, story and, like, you know, reality TV to deter me from who I am. So I was able to leave feeling proud of what I did.
Now, and then after you left MasterChef, I know you founded Dinner with Your Muslim Neighbor. Tell us about the dinners. Like, where are they and who comes?
Yeah, so my husband and I host in our homes, and we invite our neighbors, colleagues, and then I post it on Facebook, and if someone's interested, they're welcome to join us.
And what do you serve?
Depends on what I'm feeling. My comfort food is definitely Lebanese food because it reminds me of home. But we always grew up, like, eating a bunch of different things, so Italian. I like doing just kind of, like, the American farm-to-table, like, style, like, whatever's in season. Mm-hmm. I don't always plan a menu. I just kind of go to the grocery store, and what's talking to me is what I bring home and what I cook.
What inspired you to start this?
So it was actually after MasterChef that I was receiving, like, Islamophobic tweets and, like, messages on Facebook. That coupled with the 2016 presidential election and just hearing a call for a ban on Muslims coming into this country. And as an American Muslim, I didn't know how to react and I didn't know how to respond, but I definitely felt hurt and felt like I needed to do something. And for me, it was through food. So let's create a safe space for people to have dialogue, get together, and just get to know one another.
You know, food builds bridges. You're proof of that. What is the magic of food and sitting down at a table and in building those bridges between disparate communities?
I think food is a common denominator between all people. Like, we all need food, one, to, like, nourish and sustain ourselves, but we also love to eat good food. And when you can share that, it's building a connection that's, I think, subconsciously super deep. Like, we're sharing in this very necessary act of, like, humanness. So kind of, I think, brings us down to our humanness.
And we all realize, like you said, who doesn't love a good meal?
Yes.
Now, I know that you're working on a show called Chef and Hijab, and what, you're traveling across Asia in search of the best eats there. So give us an idea of where you've gone and some of the things you found that just made you go, wow.
Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. This production company in Singapore reached out to me for this concept to film a pilot in Japan. So we went all through Japan and Tokyo and Osaka, and the best food of my life. I was, like, blown away in the hospitality and just the care for their food. Like, I just went to the grocery store because I like to explore. And this isn't even on the show, but I just, like, went in my off time. And I got, like, some cucumbers and apples. Literally the best produce I've ever tasted. Delicious. And we have farm fresh, amazing produce here in Michigan. Let's not, like, undermine that.
Right, right.
But I was like, wow, this is, like, amazing. I got to try halal wagyu Kobe beef, which they only slaughter 3 cows per year, halal, and there's like this little restaurant, and they just serve that, and it was so amazing.
So we'll have to stay tuned to that.
Yes.
You know, I know you've blogged about this. What is your strategy for balancing your work and motherhood to your little Hannah?
Oh, it's days like today where I'm like, oh, I'm so missing Hannah Bear today. But we like to spend mornings together, and bedtime routine is definitely mommy. Like, I love to just read her a story and tuck her in before bed each night. But it's like days off, so I'm like so looking forward to Thursday because we'll have the full day. So we'll be up bright and early at 6 a.m. and we'll try to watch the parade together and have fun and then have family dinner.
And she's how old?
She's 15 months.
All right, so maybe a little bit young. You started at about 3 helping mom, but I suspect that tradition will be continuing.
I think so.
You know, I read on your blog, which we should tell everybody is amandasplate.com, and here's what you wrote, that to you there is no better way to tell someone you love them than to create a meal for them. So what are you going to make for your family for Thanksgiving Day?
Oh, well, the ultimate matriarch, the true giver of love, my grandmother will be cooking for 40-plus people. So I actually get the day off, but I am in charge of dessert always. That's a given in our family, and our cousins are so excited. For they're like, what are you going to bring? I'm like, we'll see. It'll be a surprise this year.
Well, we wish you much success with
Thank you so much.
Spreading some life and love and light through your baking and through the Butter Bear Shop.
Thank you so much.
Our interview at Butter Bear Shop is part of our series, Beyond the Coney, highlighting the growers, entrepreneurs, and culinary experts behind Michigan's diverse food economy. Coming up, you might have heard Detroit is on the rebound, but what of the many neighborhoods in the 139 square mile city? That story after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Things are different in parts of Detroit since the bleak days of bankruptcy. Downtown, Midtown, Corktown, they're bustling with new businesses, new restaurants, new places to live, new and largely white. But that progress has yet to make its way to many of Detroit's neighborhoods, older and largely black. Today, we're looking at two interesting efforts in a West Side Detroit neighborhood, efforts to support the families who live there and help close the gap between these two Detroits. With us today, Sonia Brown. She's known to many as Auntie Nay. She works with the Kresge Foundation and Wayne State University to create a health clinic, food pantry, clothing distribution center, and much more. It's called Auntie Nay's House. It's on Yellowstone Street on Detroit's West Side. Auntie Nay, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Rose Gorman lives and works at the nearby Tuxedo Project. Its motto, one house, one block, one neighborhood. Rose teaches creative writing out of the childhood home of Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Stephen Henderson. Rose, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with you, Rose. Tell us a little of what you do and the aims of the Tuxedo Project.
Put simply, I teach creative writing out of a house. But it's a lot more than that, especially when it comes to the programming in the space. I teach creative writing, but also facilitate reading and discussion groups. And the Tuxedo Project kind of acts as a community center more than a literary center. We house a computer lab. We host neighborhood association meetings. We also have a community library for youth and adults to come and get books. You know, we're kind of more interested in people building up their personal libraries as opposed to rushing back to return books. So we hand out books and a lot more, I hope.
And when you say teaching creative writing, to what ages?
I would say teens and adults. This summer, we kicked off our first youth program where we partnered with the downtown boxing gym. They brought some of their teenagers into our neighborhood from the east side twice a week for about 2 months. We wrote and did activities and read books and learned how to knit.
And Sonia, there's so many things happening at Auntie Nay's house. Break some of that down for us.
Wow. Chaotic. Confusion. Networking all over the place. Multitasking. No, that just sums up what it's like over there on that cornerstone of Yellowstone. But our programs are community-based. It started off with just trying to help some of the young mothers in the community with day-to-day living responsibilities, clothes and food. So I started off with just putting free clothes and food out on the corner. It went from that to babysitting. We don't do child care. We don't do daycare. We just babysit some of our babies, mostly so children aren't left at home while parents go run errands. So they're not left in cars while you go take care of things. You've actually got some place where you can bring them, and they're watched, they're monitored, they're tend to. It's enough mother hens on that corner to take care of all of our little young chicklings. But that's what we do too. But we teach, we educate, we nurture. We also offer a monthly bazaar so that the communities can come together and learn who's in the neighborhood, get to meet and greet each other. With a lot of apartments and condos coming up, you don't really get to know who your neighbor is anymore. Well, with our monthly bazaars, we offer you the ability to check on your health, to come and get food, to come and get clothing, to allow the children to come out of these apartments and play in a safe area.
And is this all in your, was this your house?
Well, initially everything started off in the home that I grew up in. My grandparents raised me there. I'm now raising my grandchildren there after raising my children there. So when I say I've been generationally embedded on that cornerstone of Yellowstone, my roots is as deep as many of those old trees that still stand there on that cornerstone of Yellowstone.
And briefly tell us about this neighborhood. It's roughly near where I-96 and the Davison Freeway intersect, kind of, so just for folks who are not real familiar with Detroit neighborhoods. But give us a sense of the condition of the neighborhood and who's living there.
To give folks a general idea of what the cornerstone of Yellowstone is, back in the day, the YBI ran everything over in that particular area. The Martindale, the Dexter.
And the YBI.
Young Boys Incorporated. The Dexter area, the Grand River area, the Livernois area, the Davison area.
And this would have been in the 70s.
This would have been in the 70s and 80s.
Very big, for those not familiar with that history, a very powerful gang.
Yes, yes, yes. And in fact, a lot of that's coming back to the news and the media now, thanks to White Boy Rick and so on and so forth. Well, growing up over in that area and raising my children over in that area, my grandparents and I withstood against a lot of that in that time. So the roots, I say again, are family roots, our generation roots. A lot of the community members found their way there during my grandparents' area, seeking out food, seeking out help. To find that particular area, as I say, the cornerstone of Yellowstone, which is the cornerstone of a community again, to see it come back where the families were destroyed through that area, to see the housing issue take place, the banks take over. It was once considered an upper middle class area at one point in time. Most of my area now, like a lot of Detroit, is depleted. Abandoned houses, vacant lots, schools closed, like a lot of Detroit.
And a few blocks away on Tuxedo Street, I know Stephen Henderson wrote a lot of deep dive stories about his boyhood home. So now it's renovated. You live there. Mm-hmm. How have the neighbors around Tuxedo Project responded to this house being renovated and you being there providing these services?
Well, I guess first just to go back, my house is renovated, but that's like the only house on the block that's like that.
Exactly.
You know? And so we do kind of stick out like a sore thumb in thinking about how my neighbors are. They're really protective of the space, especially when it comes to me, a newcomer to the city, living there. You know, I was recently out of town, and actually, whenever I go out of town, I get text messages from my neighbors just making sure I'm okay if they don't see me out and about or if my porch light stays on too long.
That unity.
Yeah.
That support, that strength. Yeah. That
is community.
That is community.
And a lot of that is lost with these apartments, the high rises, the condos, but in the sense of not being too far from you. Again, you're right there off of Livernois and Tuxedo. Jerry's Pizza on the corner.
Right there.
And again, being deeply rooted there, many years there, I myself have watched the changes that have taken place over in there. But that protection, that bond, that security of we are still part of that family net of taking care of each other is a lot of what is fed off as the main veins and arteries off of that cornerstone of Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. So I understand what you say in that sense of knowing that family unity there, because it's still there in that area, even though it's few of us still there.
Yeah. And if you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Detroit neighborhood activist Rose Gorman, the resident fellow at the Tuxedo House, where she teaches creative writing, and Sonia Brown, also known as Auntie Nay, and she's the force behind Auntie Nay's House, and both located on Detroit's west side. There is this narrative that I touched on at the beginning, at the top of this, that the neighborhoods in Detroit aren't not getting enough investment. I'm going to ask you, first of all, Rose, you're the newcomer to Detroit. What do your fresh eyes see as far as that?
That's such a big old question. Well, I think the separation of experiences that people are having, I definitely see that. You know, especially given where I live and then where I do other work outside of the house, you know, via community organizations and Mary Grove College. And, you know, this idea of two Detroits is so big. It's a really big deal. You know, some of the programming that I do in Midtown or downtown, you know, my neighbors don't really come to that or even come to, you know, some of my workshops and classes on campus at Mary Grove. So when it comes—
Why is that?
Why? Well, I mean, it's something as simple as not having access to transportation. Mm-hmm. It's also something much larger, as in thinking this programming might not be for me. You know, it's not programming that speaks to them, like a creative writing class. But I will say, you know, in the programming that happens at 7122 Tuxedo, it is open to everyone. And so that's something that's always in the back of my mind when I think about what I'm opening my door for to the neighborhood, you know, everything from community meetings to just reading and discussion groups. That's like the challenge of the work, right? Because there's this, I spoke with one of your producers earlier about this idea of isolation and access to information, access physically, but then also education-wise, mm-hmm. and exposure to things like 24-hour libraries and healthy eating and the information that comes along with quality of life mm-hmm. issues, I think.
And Auntie Nay, I saw you just kind of shaking your head when Rose described people not feeling that what was happening downtown had anything to do with them, yet it's their city. What do you see needs to happen where they would feel like what's happening downtown is relevant to them?
Well, for the most part, many of us feel displaced. We feel like the city that we once had a place in has displaced us, has left us behind, has not so much as included us as they'd like to think they have with their meetings here and there. You took over a city and you pushed us away, and now you expect us to just openly arm and welcome you back or take us back to what we felt was ours in the first place.
And when you say you, who do you mean?
I mean those of us that have lived in this city, those of us who can say their grandparents helped build this city. I heard you speak about growing up over there. Are you still living in that area?
Yeah, you're right.
But yet they come to you and ask you more about that mm-hmm. area and that mm-hmm. community, and you have more of an input on that community area than I do. We managed over there at Auntie Nay's to purchase 5 homes in that community. Now, yes, it was thanks to the Kresge grant, true enough. But it was thanks to the dedication of folks that I reached out to outside of my community area to come aboard and help me inside of my community area. Even though the members of my community are the ones that benefit from the programs that Auntie Nay's House offers. It was hard to get them to believe that they had a right to invest into their own communities, that they had a right to actually be a part of what was going on over there. So the monthly bazaars that we host give them the ability to do just that, feel like they have a right to what's there.
Can I ask a question? Because, you know, as it's interesting that you called me a community activist, and, you know, I'm new, whereas Auntie Nay has been here forever. And I'm curious, you know, speaking as a, asking you as a community organizer, how do you create space for your neighbors outside of their neighborhood? Like, how do you, like, rather than just keep, like, the monthly bazaars and everything that your organization does, how do you encourage your neighbors to take ownership of the city as a whole?
By going and getting them and taking them.
And you take them, yes. I was wondering if it was that simple because...
No, it's not. Because sometimes I get the excuse that we can't find this to wear, we don't have that.
It's a process.
It's a process, and it is. Yeah. And it's like pulling two. It's like pulling a tooth,
yeah.
One by one by one. Mm-hmm. And most of the time I find that by just meeting the day-to-day need of what they're requiring, not pushing what the city is requiring, not pushing what CPS is requiring, mm-hmm. but just pushing that I'm here.
For what you need.
For what you need.
And mm-hmm. what actually happens in these monthly bazaars at Auntie Nay's house? What do you do and what do people find when they come?
They find that they're not alone in the suffering.
So they come together and what do you have, a barbecue?
We barbecue, yeah. We have bounce houses, we have DJs, we have face painting.
We have
monthly parties. But here's what we get from that. We get to get your blood pressure. We get to get your glucose. We get to see if you are right with your health. We get to find out if you need extra help with getting utilities paid. Mm-hmm. We get to get you a recycling bin if your neighbor got one and you want one. Mm-hmm. We get to find out if the kids need extra uniforms or school supplies. We get to find out what it is we can help you do to help you. And with that, you come because you know you need it, mm-hmm. and we're willing to give it. And it's not anybody's business but yours and Auntie Nay's.
Do you both see a point where the two Detroits, this midtown Cork town, downtown largely white Detroit, and the older black neighborhoods will come together as one Detroit?
Have you seen Redford and Detroit come together?
Tell me what you mean by that.
Don't you still see the separation in that? You hear folks from Detroit still say they won't go out to Redford. You hear them still say that they won't go to Centerline. They won't drive here. They won't drive there. That difference is there. And the only way to put a stop to that difference is what we're doing now. I'm bringing in Wayne State students from different economic backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. You've got two African-American young ladies sitting here from the same community, mm-hmm. the same areas, working on basically the same projects. But you who once lived in this area are discussing an area that has changed. Mm-hmm. When is the last time you've been a part of that change? And if and we want to bring that together, that's how we've got to come together to do that.
Can you talk more about your experiences in bringing in Wayne State students? Because one of the challenges that I face on Tuxedo Street is the attention that we get from the outside, but by way of charity. Like, we have lots of schools and lots of students and lots of volunteers who want to come and do charity work and get some service hours, and then they leave.
The way they come to Gleaners.
There's no sustainability there with that. So what I have found is that it's not the sustainability I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. If I find in you what you're dedicated to over on that cornerstone of Yellowstone, don't come to me to ask me what you can do for me. Mm-hmm. I want you to come and do what you can do for the cornerstone of Yellowstone.
So do you find that that's like the students that do engage with Auntie Nay's, is that, does it have a lasting impact?
If I allow their heart to be what they're working from, mm-hmm. in the programs over there, they're putting that part of them in that. They're planting a seed of them in that. And that is what they come back to nurture. That is what they come back to apply again.
They do come back.
They do come back.
Okay.
And it's not just my Wayne State students. I mean, this initially started with Oberlin students. Imagine, all the way from Ohio.
I know, Oberlin?
Exactly. And they were coming
not
back.
Not to generalize, but.
Oh, yes. They were coming back, and they were dedicating themselves. In fact, Auntie Nay's house caught fire in 2014. We lost everything. Mm-hmm. I thought we were done. And I grew up in this home now. But the community came together. The Oberlin students came. I watched my babies, I mean little ones, come up with hammers trying to fix
That's
up
amazing.
And build up. Because it was theirs. It belonged to them. Mm-hmm. And they refused to lose that. I watch the babies help work these community the community garden over there. And they swear, they know that's their tomato plant, their cucumber plant. They planted that seed. It's letting them love them enough to do what they do in that area. And that's what brings everyone back.
And that's the kind of thing that, as we were talking about, will begin to close
the gap
between
yes,
them.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we could talk to you two all day with your great energy and your great ideas. Rose Gorman, resident fellow at the Tuxedo House, and Sonia Brown, Auntie Nay, the force behind Auntie Nay's house. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Sarah Leeson, Sam Corey, Bella Isaacs, and Natalie Brennan. I'm Cynthia Canty. From all of us, happy Thanksgiving, and thank you so very much for listening.